So the parsha this week is Parshas Kisisa. Kisisa, this is the middle portion of the four portions which talk about the Mishkan. We had Truman Tetzava, and then we'll have next week a double portion of Yaakov Pekudei. And in between, you have Parshas Kisisa, which really doesn't have a lot to do with the Mishkan. There's a little bit about the Mishkan there. What it says about the Mishkan in Parshas Kisisa is, as enthusiastic as we may be for building the Mishkan, for building the tabernacle, and the tremendous importance that the tabernacle has in bringing down the divine presence, the Shekhinah. And if you remember from a few weeks ago, I spoke about how, I quoted a Medrash, that the entire building of the Mishkan was one of the dimensions of building the Mishkan, that the command to build the Mishkan was Hashem's desire to want to be close to his Torah, to be close to his Torah. Remember this, the Medrash says that like a king who marries off his daughter, his only daughter, and he marries her off to a king, to a prince that he wants her to be married to. But in so marrying off his precious only daughter, the princess, she's going to have to depart from him. She's going to have to leave him and go to live with the new king in a different country, and that caused a lot of pain to the king. So the king says to the son-in-law, he says, "Listen, I can't tell you not to marry her because I want you to marry her, and I can't go and I can't tell you to marry and then leave her over here. So, but I can't depart from her. I can't separate from her. Can you make me a chamber? Make me a room wherever you go that I can always be near my daughter." And that was the mashal for the Torah. That the Torah is like the princess, is the daughter of the king, is the daughter of Hashem. And Hashem's desire to want us to give us the Torah is paramount. He wants to give us the Torah. He wants to give us his daughter. But at the same time, he doesn't want to separate from his daughter. He doesn't want to separate from the Torah. Because the Torah and Hashem are one together. So Hashem says, okay, I'm giving you the Torah, but make sure to make a room for me. Make a chamber for me that I call it dwell be near my daughter with the Torah. And that was the Mishkan. And it was a beautiful message in general for a shul as well, that a shul is really the place of Hashem to be near the Torah. And then we said about how important it is to keep the Torah, therefore, because that's the whole reason why the divine presence is coming down in the first place, is only because of the Torah. So the Mishkan needs no clarification in terms of this powerful experience of the divine presence descending and coming down and being in the hearts and the minds of the Jewish people. That's the Mishkan. So you could imagine that the enthusiasm of building the Mishkan, the building of the Mishkan, was with such enthusiasm and excitement and vigor that a person may say, "I'll do it every day of the week. I'll build the Mishkan every day of the week." And as soon as we have this commandment to build the Mishkan, I'll do it every day of the week. And the Torah comes along and says, "No, no, slow down, slow down. Don't go so fast. Shabbos, right? Shabbos. Don't do it on Shabbos. Don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. As important as the Mishkan is, do not build it on Shabbos." And that's why we have in the parasha this week a warning about Shabbos. I saw something really interesting. It caught my attention that if you look at that particular passage about Shabbos, it was really interesting. The pasuk says, "This is where is it? This is let's see. I'm sorry. Here. It's chapter page 491 in the art scroll. Yom Hashem Moshe Leimah, Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, 'Atadabo b'nei Yisrael,' says, 'But keep my Shabbos. Don't allow the euphoria and the excitement of building the Mishkan overtake the observance of Shabbos. Echas shabsusai tishmaru, but keep my Shabbos, ki osi beinu beinechem, for it is a sign between me and you, l'dorasechem, for your generations, l'das, to know, ki ani Hashem mekadishachem, that I am Hashem." Sorry, this is verse 12 and 13, I apologize. Right? It's in order to know that I am Hashem mekadishachem, I am Hashem who is sanctifying you. So, nothing seems to be strange about the pasuk. However, when you delve into the pasuk and the wording of it, Rashi is bothered by why it says ledas, in order to know. It's a sign between me and you for your generations, in order to know that I am Hashem who sanctifies you. So listen to what Rashi says. Rashi says, ledas, in order to know, in order for who to know? Not for us to know. Rashi says, "Ha'umos bo, ki ani Hashem mekadishachem." In order for the nations to know that I sanctify you, it's an incredible statement. In order for the nations of the world, "Ha'umos bo, ki ani Hashem mekadishachem." In order for the nations to know that I sanctify you, it's an incredible insight into the role of Shabbos and the impact that Shabbos has upon the Jewish people in terms of their reputation and prestige and respect in the eyes of the world. Right? We are always living in times when we are seeking the respect and the prestige and the honor from the world and that nation, not for the sake of our own honor, but for the sake of safety and security. We want the world to look at the Jewish people with favor. We want the world to look at us with favor. We're constantly looking for that. We need that. We need the secure. We need the favor of the nations of the world. We need that. I mean, of course, all it comes ultimately from Hashem, but the world is the nations of the world is just a conduit. They are just tools and agents in Hashem's hands. In order to win the favor of the nation, in order for the nation of the world to respect us and to recognize the kedusha of Klal Yisrael, right over here, Shabbos. Shabbos is the key. Shabbos is the key to have reputation and prestige in the eyes of the world. That they should know that Hashem sanctifies us. Shabbos. Unbelievable. That's the purpose. So keeping Shabbos is so essential for our prestige, reputation, safety, security, and regard in the world, in the eyes of the world. That's what Shabbos is. That's what Pasuk says. I'm not saying anything more than just the Pasuk and the Rashi. Ki osi b'neu b'neichem. It's a sign between me and you. For your generation, ledas, so that the world can see, kani Hashem mekadishachem, that Hashem sanctifies you. Unbelievable, just beautiful, just right there, black and white, and the Rashi right over there. So that's what that. So, but this passage of Shabbos is mentioned in the context of the Mishkan, that don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos, right? And then the Psukim go on, and retells the. You know, the incredible story, the tragic story, the infamous story of the Chet Ha'Egel, the sin of the golden calf. That's what this portion is famous for, the sin of the golden calf. The Yar Ha'am Kiboshes Moshe, the people saw that Moshe had delayed in coming down the mountain. And this was the beginning of the story because they saw he was delayed in coming back down from the mountain. They were expecting to come down from the mountain at a certain point, and he wasn't coming down. And he said when he was coming down, this is after the 40 days, after he went up to the mountain, they'd already experienced the revelation 40 days earlier, and they'd heard Hashem speak, they heard the Ten Commandments, but then Moshe went back up to the mountain to now receive the tablets, to bring the tablets down with the tablet, the Ten Commandments etched upon them. And he told the people when he was planning to come down, there was a miscalculation. There's a whole discussion about that. There was a miscalculation. And they expected him to come down at a certain hour, and he didn't come down. And they saw he was delayed. And that's what began the process. And it says, Ve'yikoh ba'yikohel ha'om al Aaron. They gathered around Aaron, ve'yomru lev. And they said to him, Kum asay lano Elohim asher yelchu lefaneinu. Rise up and make for us gods that go before us. Kizeh Moshe ha'ish asher alino. We don't know where he went. What happened to him? This is not like Moshe. He was so accurate and so precise and assuring about everything which he did, and he's not coming down. And we need now something else. We need something else. So let me read to you the Kuzari. The Kuzari is one of the great Rishonim. And I'm just reading this. He's among many Rishonim who discuss the Chet Ha'Egel. I want to read through what he says just to get an appreciation in general and to eradicate from our minds that this was out and out, like, you know, base Avodah Zarah. It's not out and out base Avodah Zarah idolatry. And the Kuzari, by the way, this book is called the Kuzari. This is a very classic work. It's written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, one of the Rishonim, and it's a dialogue between him and a non-Jewish king, and he was asking questions about searching about his religiosity and deciding which religion he wants to adopt, and he's having conversations with Islamic leaders and the Christian leaders and now with the rabbi as well. And it's a conversation back and forth. And he asks him, he says, you know, what's going on? How could there be any remnant of greatness of the Jewish people after the sin of the golden calf? So the rabbi responded, he says, in those days, every people worshipped images. In those days, that was a common thing. Even philosophers, even if philosophers had been able to prove to everyone the existence of the one omnipotent God, they still would not have relinquished their images. This is because they would focus their attentions upon the image and would profess to the masses that divinity attaches itself to the image and that it is a unique in some supernatural way. Some would attribute this uniqueness directly to God. We do something like this today when we treat certain places with certain reverence, with special reverence. Mm. We will even consider the soil and the rocks of these places as sources of blessing. Others would attribute the image's supernatural qualities to a certain star, planet, constellation, or the like. The masses would not accept upon themselves any religious teaching unless it was accompanied by some image upon which they would focus their attention. During this period in history, Israel was waiting for that which Moshe had promised to bring down to them from God, something they could see and focus upon, just as they had focused upon the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire when they left Egypt. They would gaze and concentrate upon the pillars and would exalt them by bowing down to God's presence in front of them. They behaved the same way with the pillar of cloud, which descended upon Moshe when God spoke to him. The nation had heard the Ten Commandments, and Moshe ascended the mountain to bring down the engraved tablets and place them in an ark. The objective was to have something tangible, something that would contain a record of the covenant between God and Israel and a divine new creation, namely the tablets themselves. Additionally, the divine presence hovered over it. But Moshe tarried for 40 days. Tarried for 40 days. Well, he was supposed to tarry for 40 days, but he was, you know, more than 40 days in their calculation. And it was then that an evil thought overtook a small minority of the nation. That has to be underscored as well. It's a small minority who initially engaged in the sin of the golden calf. This minority fought among themselves in proposing various ideas and courses of action, until finally a group of them banded together to make a tangible object, this tangible vehicle of worship, an object of worship, something upon which they could be able to focus, just like all the other nations. Their intent was not to deny the God who took them out of Egypt. Rather, it was to have something in front of them upon which they could concentrate when recounting God's wonders. We do the same thing when you ascribe the divinity to the skies and to other things. In the footnotes of this copy over here, he says, for example, even we have expression, Yiras Shemayim. Yiras Shemayim, the fear of heaven. I mean, the fear of heaven. That is not like attributing power to another intermediary power. But that's what we do. We say, for the sake of heaven, fear of heaven, etc. So he said we do the same thing. Their sin, therefore, was the making of an image which was forbidden to them. They weren't allowed to do this. The sin was not avodah zarah in the basest sense of the word. It was making something which they were not commanded to make, to use as a vehicle, and to use as a way to supplant and replace the absence of Moshe. Their sin, therefore, was the making of an image which was forbidden. They further sinned by ascribing divinity to something which they themselves had constructed without the sanction of God. The sin was not a departure from worshiping the God who took them out. It was a revolt against a fraction of his commandments, a certain portion of his commandments. For Hashem had commanded them not to make images representing him, and they went ahead and did it. They should have continued waiting instead of relying on their own intellects. And I could go on, there's more and more pages on this, but this is what the commentators say, and different variations of this, but they're looking for some kind of intermediary, some type of vehicle to stand as intermediary in the absence of Moshe. And that was and again, it's like not more to be said about it than that. And that's what the Kuzri says, the Ramban says a similar idea as well. But look, I'm going to zoom in now. Take a look at verse 4. Verse 4 says, I want to read these verses, these words specifically. Let me just go back up, sorry. Go back. It said they said to Aaron, you be the one to do it for us. And then he said to them, Aaron said to them, okay, parku nizmeh, this is verse 2 still, take off your golden jewelry in your ears, women, etc. Bring them to me. They took them off. They took off the jewelry. They took off the gold. And verse 4. Vayikach miyodam. And Aaron took all this stuff from their hand. Vayotza usa becheret. And there's actually two definitions of this term. Right? Vayotza usa becheret. One Rashi says one meaning of this phrase is that he bundled it all up into a cheret. A cheret is like a handkerchief, a kerchief. Right. The second pshat is Yotza. He formed it with a cheret. The word cheret is like a craftsman's instrument to carve out and to etch out a shape. And this, according to the first understanding, it is that he just put into a bowl, the gold into some kind of kerchief. And the second is he actually started the process of etching something out, mysterious exactly what's going on, but Yaseyu Egel, and he made it into an eagle, Maseich, into this molten eagle. Mysterious words. And then they all said, Eila Elohecha Yisraeliza, your God Israel, Shaluchu, to took you out of Mitzrayim. But now I want to look at Rashi. Rashi says, the first Peshat Rashi says is that that Aaron did it, that Aaron actually made it, did something. You know, whatever he did exactly, can't really identify the specific details, but generally what I just said about the cloth and the craftsman's instrument, etc. But the first understanding Rashi brings is that Aaron was the one who's doing this. And it says that he made an eagle, Masech, an eagle is a calf, right? A golden calf. Rashi is a cave and shashlichu l'oro. Once he cast this gold and this stuff into the fire of the crucible, bo mechashve erev ra. So Rashi adds in that there's more to the story than the sorcerers of the erev rav, the sorcerers of the mixed multitude. Mixed multitude are those Egyptians who wanted to attach themselves and become part of the Jewish people and convert. You know, they came out of Mitzrayim too. The sorcerers among them came along, Sha'alu Imaim in Mitzrayim, who came out from Mitzrayim with them. Vasumach B'Keshafim, and they're the ones who turned it into the eagle with their witchcraft and their black magic. That's explanation number one. Explanation number two, listen carefully. Yesh Omrim, there are those who say, Micha Haya Sham. Micha was there. Now, this shouldn't be confused with Micha the prophet. There is that one of the prophets is Micha. There's not Micha the prophet. There was an individual by the name of Micha, who was there. Shiyotze mitoch de musei binyan, that he emerged out of the bricks of the building in Mitzrayim, buildings in Mitzrayim, shenis moyach bo Mitzrayim, that he was crushed inside of Mitzrayim. This is a Medrash Tanchuma. Says, I mean, you may be familiar with that, one of the horrible things the Egyptians did to the Jews in Mitzrayim is to take babies and put them into the walls and build them up, you know, build the walls up. They would build the walls up because of you know, there's not enough cement, not enough bricks. And they would put babies into the walls to make them part of the walls. And there was the horrific persecution, terrible things they did. And that's what the Medrash says of what they did to Jewish babies inside Mitzrayim. So Micha was one of those individuals. He was one of those babies. So Rashi said, I'll read the Medrash where this comes from. The Medrash says that when this was going on in Mitzrayim, that it was terrible. So Mashi Hitzel Moshe Menelevein, reading one part of it. Give me a second. I didn't go the whole thing. Okay. I have a translation of it over here. I thought I had it over there. Give me a second. Sorry. So I'll read it from this. Paro decreed that if the Israelites could not meet their quota of bricks, they would have to complete their construction by cementing their children. When Moshe voiced a grievance to Hashem over this, he said to him, well, how can you do this? How can this be happening? Hashem told him that those who are being killed in this way would have been wicked in any event, and told him to save one of those children to see the truth of his words. The child Moshe saved was Micha. Micha was one of these children to prove to him that his word, that the reason why they're being killed is because Hashem knows the bigger picture. And I don't want to go into this topic right now about why things happen, children, etc., etc. you know, Hashem knows what he's doing, right? And there are times when people are removed from the world earlier than later because of the potential harm they're going to do down the road. That's a principle. It makes sense. It's a principle. That's what Hashem was saying to Moshe in this instance here. That I understand your grievance and I understand your horror about these children being killed, but I know what's going. I know where they're going to be going. And we know that only 1/5 of the Jewish people came out of Mitzrayim. Mm. There are many Jews who didn't believe in Hashem, didn't believe, and there were souls, there were people who potentially would have become Rishayim afterwards. And he says that's who these babies are. And I'll prove to you, because take one of those babies and you'll see what happens to him. He took one of those babies, and that one baby, his name was Micha. And what happened to him? Micha was the one over here to make the eagle. Because Rashi continues on our pasuk. Micha took a, he was that baby, one of those, that baby was taken out. There was there, he had like a piece of metal. He had a metal plate. Micha had a metal plate that was written on it the words Ale Shor, rise up, O ox, rise up, O ox. What are these words? What are those words from? Those in Mitzrayim, before they left Mitzrayim and before Moshe left, he wanted to fulfill the pledge that he made to Yosef, or the Jewish people made to Yosef, that Yosef should be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Mm. Where was Yosef in Mitzrayim after he passed away? He was in the Nile. Mm. The Egyptians wouldn't let him. They thought that his power in Mitzrayim would still benefit Mitzrayim, mm, and benefit the Nile by being buried inside the Nile. Mm. So Yosef was put into, the Egyptians put Yosef into an aron, into a casket, and put him inside the Nile. They didn't know where he was. So when Moshe was leaving, when they were leaving Mitzrayim, Moshe wanted to fulfill the pledge to Yosef that he should be buried in Eretz Yisrael. So he took, and this is all mystical, he took a piece of metal, some kind of metal plate, and on the metal plate was engraved the words, Ale Shor. The words Ale Shor means rise up, O ox. Rise up, O ox. And the word ox, Shor, is because Yosef was called, in the brachas that Moshe gave to the Jewish people, to Yosef, and Yaakov gave to Yosef also, Yosef is referred to an ox. He's referred to a mighty ox, Bechor Shor, mm, the firstborn ox. Mm. And he, on this plate was written, "Rise up, O ox! Rise up, Shor!" And he threw this into the Nile. He held it. He threw it on the Nile. And exactly what he did. And then the Aaron came up, rising up out of the Nile River. And that's how they're able to retrieve the Aaron of Yosef and take him out of Mitzrayim. Mm. Micha, you know, amazingly, Micha had this piece of metal. Now, Moshe wasn't here at the time because Moshe was up on the mountain. He hadn't come down yet. Mm-hmm. Micha had this piece of metal upon which was engraved the words, Ale Shor.
That's good.
Rise up, O ox, rise up, O ox. He was the one who had to take that piece of metal and he threw it into the fire and now caused another ox to come out, mm-hmm, the eagle. The calf came out of it. He took that piece of metal, which was written on it, which Moshe wrote on it, Ali Shor, Ali Shor, Lahalis Aron, in order to write, to lift up the Aron of Yosef, Mitoch Nils, from the Nile River, Veshlicha Letocha Kor, and Micha cast it into the crucible, the Yotza HaEgel, and the eagle came out. Mm. It's unbelievable. It's just such a paradoxical, incredible medrash, because it's, you know, to think that because Yosef was buried in Mitzrayim, or was inside the Nile River, all because of that, the eagle came out. Because Micha took that piece of metal which brought Yosef out of the river and now caused the eagle to come out of the fire. I don't have anything more to say on it than that. It's just an incredible, it's paradoxical. I mean, and also Micha, by the way, is the same Micha who appears in chapter 17 of the book of Shoftim. Mm. That's a very famous story, Pesel Micha. Mm. Pesel Micha is the idol of Micha. That's the story in the book of Judges, chapter 17, where it's many, many years later. In fact, it's confusing because it sounds like it's hundreds of years later. And in that story there, we see Micha again with his mother, right? And it's the same Micha. And they're living in the territory of Ephraim. Mm. And he stole from his mother all this gold. And then he owned up that he stole the gold from his mother. And she was very happy with him. And she says, well, I was actually going to sanctify this gold to God. And then they ended up making an idol out of that gold. So a repeat of the Chet HaEgel. Now, even though it's hundreds of years later, which seems like really very far in the future, I mean, very hundreds of years later, and that's his mother as well. Some commentaries say that it really took place out of order. It's one of those examples where the Tanakh is out of order, not in chronological order, and the story really took place much sooner after they've left Mitzrayim. But it's the same Micha with the same, almost the same story again of the Chet HaEgel. I mean, that story of Pesel Micha is not a badge of honor for the Jewish people. They had this because Micha in that episode sets up his home as a temple, and ironically he has a Levi who's serving in that temple in his home, and that Levi is identified as grandson of Moshe. It's a very very mysterious story. But to think that because Yosef was buried was in the night, this brings about the Chet HaEgel, and Micha is the one who's doing it, is bringing it, and he's being saved from Mitzrayim in order to demonstrate to Moshe that, you know, that sometimes people, these babies, their destiny was rishus, their destiny was evil, and our Micha was the demonstration of that. That's how the Chet HaEgel came about. So that Micha becomes like the kind of the harbinger of this philosophical truth, the philosophical truth that sometimes Hashem takes people away earlier than later in order to avoid them, to prevent them from committing more sins down the road. Micha was chosen for that purpose in this story. It's a mind-boggling story. It's very just mysterious, but it's you know, I don't have any more to say just than that. Just this, it's a similar, the two stories of Yosef being brought up out of the river, the eagle being brought up out of the fire, and one final expression of being brought up, because in this same pasuk where it says that they made the eagle and they called out, verse 4, it says, V'yomru, and then they said, Eilo Elohecha Yisrael, these are your gods, Israel. Asher lucha mi'etz Mitzrayim, that they brought you up out of Mitzrayim. We don't normally talk about leaving Mitzrayim as being brought up out of Mitzrayim. We always talk about the expression going out of Mitzrayim. And here the verse says, these are the gods that brought you up out. I just thought it was just interesting, the similarities between these dynamics going on. Yosef's Aaron being brought up out of the Nile River with this piece of metal, the eagle being brought up out of the fire with this piece of metal, Jewish people being brought up out of Mitzrayim. Okay, I'm not. I like to try to answer all these questions. I spend a lot of time trying to understand better this story with Micha and his role in it and the connection to Yosef. I didn't yet discover any more clarity, but I want to just go to another point. No, I mean, there's so many more things. I mean, so many commentaries. You know, Aaron's role in all this. Aaron's role, because, you know, the whole thing began with Aaron agreeing to take the gold from the Jewish people to then be used for the construction or the design of this golden calf. So, you know, was he in the right? Was he in the wrong? Was he in the right or in the wrong? So in Devarim, where the story is repeated, where the story is recapped in Sefer Devarim, It definitely says over there that Aaron is attributed, he's given some kind of guilt for being participatory in the construction and the building of the eagle. However, there's a Medrash which gives us, again, you know, Medrash always gives us the backstory, the behind the scenes of everything. And the Medrash says there's a lot more to what Aaron was doing and is alluded to in the verses. Medrash says, V'yar Aaron, the Aaron saw, Mara, what did Aaron say? The pasuk says in verse 5, is Aaron saw what they did. What did he see? He says, "Imbonim hey Moses, if they build this this eagle, if they're going to do this and going to go ahead and build this and turn this into a real avodah zarah, so mevitzor zem mevitzor v'zem evan." He says, "This one is going to bring a piece of stone. This one's going to bring a rock." V'nimtzes malachtum kol b'basachas. If everybody does it together in partnership, the whole thing is going to be made much faster. Now, even though I just quoted the Medrash that Micha made it come out magically, maybe this medrash is, I don't know how it stims with this medrash here, but maybe this is before that. But in any event, Aaron said, if everyone participates together in a partnership, it will happen much faster. Mitoch shani bona, if I do it myself and I get all the gold and I do it myself, I'm much more, I think this is going in accordance with the first explanation. I mentioned before, the Medrash. The first explanation that was, it wasn't Micha. Remember, I said before that there's Yesh Omrim. There are those who say it was Micha who did it. The first explanation, it wasn't Micha was doing it; it was him and doing it. So this Medrash would accord with that. But any event, he says Moshe Aaron said, if I have everyone do it in partnership, the whole thing will happen faster. I'd rather do it myself, and this way I can slow down. I can be lazy and slow down in my actions and what I do in making this egel. Rabbeinu Moshe Yored. In the meantime, Moshe was going to come down. So he was basically stalling for time. This is one example how he was stalling for time. And Moshe is going to come down, and then we'll get rid of any Avodah Zarah. If I build it, and I can also have the right kavana in making it, in case when these other people who are making it have the wrong intention in mind to dedicate it towards Avodah Zarah, that's bad news. I'll have Hashem's name in mind when doing this. So it shouldn't be as unholy as they would be doing it for. And that's why it says, V'yikra Aaron V'yom Echag LaHashem, when it says, tomorrow is a Chag LaHashem, the verse says. This is what Aaron said. It's a festival to Hashem. The stress is on to Hashem. Chag LaEgel Mocha. And because it doesn't say Chag to the, it doesn't say a festival to the eagle. It says a festival to Hashem tomorrow, emphasizing the infusion of his Kavana L'Shem Shemaim as much as possible to stall for time. Now the Pasuk says, Yar Aaron, the Aaron saw Marod, you see. Aaron says, "Bonim hein osa sirkon nitlabem." If they build it, the guilt will be on their shoulders, on their heads. Muta shi'atala sirkon be. Better that the guilt and the stain should be on my head than theirs, and not the Jewish people's. He wanted to absolve them. It was a tremendous act of mesiras nefesh that he didn't want to have the guilt on their heads. Rabbi Abba Bar Yutin said in the Rabba, Moshe le ben Malachim, it can be compared to a son of a king, Shinis Gaya Libo Olav, that the son of the king became very arrogant and prideful. V'lokech Asayev, and he didn't like, he wanted to rebel against his own father. He took a sword in order to cut off his father's head. Amar lo Padgogo, so Padgogo is came along. One of the caretakers of the prince, the prince's caretaker, saw this and said to him, "Don't do it yourself. Don't exert yourself to go and cut off your head of your father. Give the sword to me, and I'll slash the king." The king's watching. The king's peering at him. The Medrash says, and hears and says to him, "Oh, I know what your intention was. You were thinking that it's better that the foulness of the sin be attributed to you and not to my son." As a reward, the king says to the caretaker, "I swear by your life, you'll never depart from my palace. You shall eat the remnants of the food of my table, and you'll receive 24 entitlements from me." And that's the mashal for Aaron. Similarly, Hashem said to Aaron, because Aaron was willing to take the guilt himself and take the sin himself by doing it himself, he said to Aaron, he said, "You'll never depart from my palace." As it said regarding the Kohen Gadol, "You'll never leave the sanctuary." He was given this, like, you know, this title. "You'll never leave my sanctuary. You'll be my Kohen Gadol because of what you did. You shall eat the remnants of my table. You shall eat the karbanos, the remnants of the meal offerings is for Aaron and his sons. And you shall receive the 24 entitlements. For these are the 24 entitlements of gifts of the priesthood, which were granted to Aaron and his sons." So Hashem is praising Aaron for diverting the sin away from the Jewish people to take the sin himself. And Hashem, and this medrash really underscores the righteousness of Aaron. And you look at the verses on the surface, it looks like he's as much as nefarious as everyone else. But really, there's a lot more. And he's stalling for time. He's trying to avoid the Jewish people from sinning. So I saw over here in this commentary that Bar Yosef, he says that, you know, how do you reconcile this? How do you reconcile, wait, careful, is he okay? How do you reconcile this medrash of how now really behind the scenes, much, much more righteous behavior of Aaron with the fact that elsewhere in Devarim, he's attributed to being like the guilty party of the golden calf. Mm. So the Bar Yosef says, he says, because Hashem doesn't look at things black and white. People look at people black and white. We look at people black and white. So, you know, if a person's intentions are bad and the outcome is bad, they are bad through and through. If their intentions are good and the outcome is good, they are good through and through. We don't look at every single detail. But sometimes along the journey of, from a bad intention to a bad outcome, there could be very good steps along the way. And sometimes likewise, conversely, from a very good intention to a good outcome, there can be bad steps along the way as well. And it's that you don't look at things, you know, broadly, black and white. We have to look at things individually. And people are more complex than they meet meets the eye. Hashem looks at people for who they really are through and through, from beginning to end. And even if there are parts of our lives which are dark, but there are parts which are bright, and therefore we get rewarded for the bright parts, for the good parts. And there are parts of our lives which are dark and bad, which are good, but there are parts which are bad. We get punished for the things which are bad as well. So Hashem does not look at things black and white, and that's really that's the reconciliation. Then on the one hand, yes, there is over here, there is something to blame Aaron for. There is something to blame Aaron for, right? There is something to blame him for. It says, he says that on the one hand, in the final analysis, he did facilitate the making of the golden calf, which was worshipped by thousands of Jews. Thus, it was rightly called the calf that Aaron made, and he was punished for that. But it doesn't mitigate all of the good parts of it as well. A very good lesson, you know, and to try to emulate that trait of not looking at things in a black and white way. One final point on the eagle, another thing in the psukim, right? In the aftermath of what happened in the verse, it says that, where is it? It says that, verse 8. Soru mahem in aderach. The Jewish people quickly departed from the path, quickly departed from the way that I've commanded. This is what Hashem's saying to Moshe. Moshe's up on the mountain, and he's finding out what's going on down there from Hashem. So Hashem said, they've strayed quickly from the way that I've commanded, quickly. So soru mahem min aderach. They've quickly departed from the way, quickly. Now, that's a little bit unusual. We know one thing the Gemara says about the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara never jumps on a person fast. The Yetzer Hara never jumps on a person quickly, right? The Yetzer Hara's technique is slowly but surely. It says, today do this, tomorrow do that, next day you'll do this. Gradually, slowly, like it gets you. Because otherwise, people are too smart to be hijacked by the Yetzer Hara so quickly. You don't suddenly become irreligious overnight. You don't suddenly throw away mitzvahs overnight. Right, it takes time. It takes a long time. That's why, actually, the word, the Greeks, time of Hanukkah, the Greeks are the nation of the four nations who persecuted the Jewish people. They are the ones who are credited or discredited for leading the Jewish people away from Yiddishkeit. You know, that was their campaign to rid Judaism, rid the Jewish people of their Judaism, their spirituality. The Greeks are called Yavonim. The word Yavon is spelled Yud Vav Nun. If you look at the word Yud Vav Nun, you spell it out, look at those letters. It looks like this, a Yud, followed by a Vav, followed by a Nun. They're all identical shapes. The difference is the first one is very short. The next letter is a bit longer. The next letter is even longer. And that captures the dynamic of the Yetzer Hara. Starts off very small and then gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It takes time. So the Yetzer Hara never jumps on a person, never steers a person away from his path really fast and really rapidly. Except here it does, because the pasuk emphasizes it doesn't just say soru min aderech. They turned away from Hashem. Soru mahem min aderech. They turned away quickly from Hashem. Quickly. Why quickly? So how did that happen? How did they turn away so quickly? So I think Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, the famous Rosh Yeshiva, the Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, Chaim Shmulevitz says, he says, because the uniqueness of this story here and the uniqueness of how the Yetzer Hara was able to overtake them, what was the original beginning of the story? Because Moshe hadn't come down from the mountain. They were in a state of despondency. They were in a state of despondency and despair. And when a person's in a state of despondency and despair, then that's fertile ground for the Yetzer Hara to attack a person very, very quickly. Despondency and despair is the most fertile ground for a person to go off the derech, to go off the derech and to be attacked and to be arraigned by the Yetzirah. When you're in despair, you know, it used to be, I've never seen this in more recent years, but maybe when I was younger, I saw this at airports, Hare Krishnas at airports.
Yes.
I don't know if they're still in business anymore, but airports was a very, this is a fact, they used to be, airports was a good location to try to missionize people. And the reason is because airports, people are vulnerable at airports. Their emotions, a lot of people are en route. They're leaving places. They're unstable. There's like a certain instability at an airport. People are, you know, sometimes they're traveling somewhere because of a tragedy. I mean, it's like, it's not a very, you're out of your sorts. You're not in your regular location. And it's a good place to kind of get people when they're more vulnerable, when they're not in their regular situation. But depression and desperation is fertile ground for the Yetzirah. And that's what happened. They were distraught and distressed because Moshe had disappeared. At times of great emotional stress, a person could be susceptible to spiritual threats. This is also what happened with the blasphemer in Vayikra, the story of the blasphemer, that it says, the Pasuk says, he went out and he blasphemed against Hashem. So the Medrash says, where did he go out from? So the Medrash says he went out of Moshe's Beis Din. He went left Moshe's Beis Din after having denied his claim to inheritance, right? He was denied his claim to an inheritance in the land of Israel, and he was down. He was depressed. He was upset. Didn't have a portion of the land of Israel. And then he blasphemes Hashem because, you know, when you're down and out, you're feeling down. You're feeling that, you know. You know, when a person's feeling down, they also don't feel they're worth anything. And if you're not worth anything, you don't take care of yourself either. That's another just a psychological reality. When you're down, you don't value yourself. If you don't value yourself, you don't take care of yourself. You don't take care of yourself physically. You don't take care of yourself spiritually either. And that's why a person has to always be, you know, always try to maintain positive attitudes no matter what. And here's an amazing one. It says, the Gemara says that when we learned about Shlomo Melech also a few weeks ago, and his descent, and he lost his kingdom towards the end. He was tremendously, fabulously wealthy, had tremendous power and control based on Mikdash. And the end of his life, he lost it. He lost it all, right? But the Pasuk says at the end of his life that he was a molech al maklo, which is translated, he was just merely a king over his own staff, over his own stick. So, which sounds like a sad state of affairs, a sad description of how he'd lost everything. But again, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, he says, no, it's on the contrary, because that was the chokmah of Shlomo, that even after he lost everything, even after he lost everything, and normal people would have been crushed to defeat and be defeated, he didn't want to lose his dignity. And he wanted to hold on to something and hold on and be able to have some kind of dominion and control and, you know, to stand up tall over something. With such wisdom, with such an attitude, a person can inoculate himself against the whims and temptations that come from the Yetzirah in times of despair and desperation. So that's the lesson we learned from that. And they quickly went off, and we have to always maintain our positive equanimity, even if things are bad, things are going bad. Never lose despair, never go into despair, never lose hope, because losing hope and going into a state of desperation and depression is a surefire invitation for the Yetzirah to come quickly, like it did with the Chet HaEgel. So may we absorb these lessons and apply them in our lives.